more. Baby, it's not mine. Not a chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are right smack dab in the middle of it. Right smack dab in the middle. We are right smack dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with
Charlotte Littlefield Brown. And gentlemen, Dr. Farrell, welcome back.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
That is worth repeating. What you said it quite eloquently and easily, but it's actually a very profound concept and important information about perceiving, what you see depends on where you stand. And to perhaps look at it, look at the information and the symbology and from an aspect of as an effort to retain a higher level of physics for perpetuum by using symbology. I mean, that's pretty profound.
Well, it's something that I'm increasingly kind of amazed when I examine these ancient texts and some of the symbols themselves, and even on through the Middle Ages in Western Europe. You have this very peculiar, and I even reproduce some of these things in my first book, The Giza Death Star. You have this very peculiar presence within esoteric texts of things that, for all intents and purposes, look like some sort of electrical circuit.
Really, like a schematic almost, huh?
Yeah, schematics would be a good way to put it. And, you know, I don't know whether or not that's true in this particular case, but I think it's certainly true when you examine things like the swastika or the so-called Star of David and so on and so forth. I think what you're really looking at, if you know the physics and can see what it's doing in these ancient texts, I think you have to look at some of these symbols in that fashion.
The Star of David is also called the hexagram, and it's a mandala symbol found in Indian Hindu temples thousands of years ago. So this is a very old symbol.
Oh yes, absolutely it is.
Could the secret societies be holding these secrets, closely holding these secrets? Is that what the secret societies are about in one way, possibly?
Well, I think to a degree this is true. I think it's certainly a component within some branches of Freemasonry. I think it's certainly the case in some of the Rosicrucian societies. But the ones that exemplify it for me the best, really, would be some of the medieval alchemists, some of the people involved in the Royal Society in Great Britain when it gets its start, because after all, Isaac Newton was better known in his time as an alchemist than he was as a scientist, and most of his publications are actually in that field. So, you know, you have that consideration. And, of course, in Germany, between the wars, many of these societies made it as kind of their goal, to some extent, to recover some of this stuff. In other words, they were definitely of the idea that some of these ancient texts had or contained a hidden science if you knew how to decode it. So, yeah, I think you have to go to that viewpoint to some extent.
Sure, and actually I don't mean to interject the Atlantis mythology, but I think contained within the mythology is the idea that the wisdom or the knowledge, the information got divided up. And part of it went east and part of it went west or something. And so,
was it lost or something due to catastrophic events,
well,
would you say, or what?
Well, are you asking me or her?
Yeah, doctor, yeah, what would you say, doctor, about this knowledge? Was it secreted away and held closely by certain secret groups, or was it lost maybe?
Yes, I think that's one aspect of it. And let me respond in two ways to this whole issue. One of the things I talk about throughout the Great Pyramid books and on into the Cosmic War is that you have a preservation of this stuff, but the stuff is being preserved by civilizations that have declined in their science. In other words, as sophisticated as the cultures of ancient Sumer and China and Egypt were, you're still looking at societies, especially in Egypt and Sumer's case, that tell you that in their own texts that they are a legacy of something much older and much more sophisticated. So to a certain extent, this handing down of this lost science occurs in the only technical language available to them at the time, and that's the language of religion and metaphysics. So it's very interesting when you do the physics analysis of these texts, what actually springs out of them. But on the other point of Atlantis, one of the things I point out in the first two pyramid books, and I discuss it again in The Cosmic War, is that if you look at Plato's actual legend of Atlantis carefully, and from this physics point of view, you get a very carefully contrived story that is capable of being interpreted in terms of this physics on a multitude of levels. And that's really the key here, because it's for this precise reason that I shun the idea of using that story as a basis for simply looking for an earthbound place to find Atlantis. I think you can certainly do so. I'm not saying that you can't, but I'm saying that this may not really be the import of the story. The story may actually be a very carefully contrived Platonic myth operating on all four of the levels that Plato himself in his other writings says he's writing about. So, you know, you have to view even Plato to a certain extent as a bearer of some of this esoteric tradition.
Yes, the secret societies are taken up greatly with Plato and his writings and his ideas.
Oh yes, definitely.
The Neoplatonists and so forth. So this would indicate possibly and verify what you just said.
Oh yes, well, you mentioned the Neoplatonists, and it's very interesting because I concentrate a great deal on the writings of the Neoplatonists in the last of the pyramid books, the Giza Death Star Destroyed. And in one entire chapter, I attempt to show, that you can take these texts and actually do a formal mathematical topological analysis of some of the concepts in them. So in other words, when you look at them from that point of view, out pops all of this physics, and you know, it's a rather breathtaking thing that emerges when you do that.
Wow.
So maybe the idea of farms is indicative of there being more than one reality, but depending on the energy fields and the manipulation of energy, could that be an interpretation?
Yes. Well, I think, again, that when Plato, I reproduce a table that was made actually by a famous Roman Catholic scholar of philosophy by the name of Francis Copleston, a Jesuit. You know, there you can actually still buy his philosophy texts. And I reproduce this table in the Giza Death Star Deployed, and then I show that you can take this table and parallel it with some of the conceptions within the practices of ceremonial magic. And then you can take it further and parallel it with some of the ideas or conceptions within modern mathematics, particularly in topology. So in other words, again, I think that you are dealing with all of these traditions with something that was deliberately contrived in order to preserve this scientific knowledge. And with Plato's forms, then, I think what we're really dealing with is a kind of popularized version of some of these very abstract mathematical conceptions.
Is there a merger then between magic and science that is occurring, a fusion, a merger between these two terms and dynamics? Is that sort of what indicate what you're saying?
Well,
or a realization on a scientific basis of what they were able to do with magic before, something like that?
Well, that's an excellent question. I hear the music.
Okay, we'll come back. I'll let you think about it, Doctor. I'll let you meditate about it, okay?
We'll
be right back.
Too.
We got to go, Charlotte. We'll be right back. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Charlotte. Doctor.
Waiting for a day that won't come.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with
Charlotte Littlefield Brown.
Welcome back, Dr. Farrell.
Thank you.
Have you been doing your meditation there? Or whatever?
Yeah.
You're quite a thinker. I will say that I really respect the depth of your knowledge and in this area.
Well, thank you. In answer to your question about whether or not we have a merger of science and magic, it's really kind of an interesting way you put that, because that, of course, was one of the concerns of the Christian apologist C.S. Lewis many years ago. He wrote something to that effect in one of his books. But I think what we're really looking at is something slightly different. I think you are looking at a picture where, at least as far as Nazi Germany is concerned, you have a deliberate effort for the first time in modern history, really, of a major world power committing serious financial labor personnel and technological resources to possibly an examination of some of this ancient lore and legends and so on, with a view to discovering if, in fact, they, first of all, contain a science, and secondly, if that science can be recovered and used for its military potential. And the reason I say that is that in 1935, Reichsfuhrer Himmler, who, of course, ran the entire SS and Gestapo and all of those secret intelligence departments of Nazi Germany, Reichsfuhrer Himmler decreed into existence a whole department of the SS called the Ahnenerbedienst. And most people are familiar with this that have researched Nazism and the occult. Its literal name is the Ancestral Research Bureau. But they miss what the decree itself actually says and what the real idea behind this bureau was. He says that the purpose of it is to examine all of these ancient things for the purpose of their potential military application. So in other words, you have a clear commitment, at least as far as the SS is concerned, of a whole department of the Nazi government doing these things. So I think we're looking more at a case, if we extend that paradigm to what's going on today in the other world powers, I think that you do have some sort of very covert, very secret attempt on their part to decode the science that is in some of these texts.
Wow.
Was the Thule Society involved in this through Himmler and so forth or not?
Well, the Thule Gesellschaft is really kind of an interesting thing in and of itself. There is a kind of a circumstantial case. In fact, it's kind of funny you ask that, because coincidentally I'm writing a chapter in the new book precisely about that question.
Hey, it's secretism, doctor.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
But I think a circumstantial case can be made that there are influences at play in some of the people that are involved in the Thule Gesellschaft and then later in the Nazi Party to do precisely that. And what I'm doing right now is researching how those influences kind of dovetail into each other. But definitely, I think the Thule Gesellschaft is involved in some of this activity.
Well, I tell you, would you be open to taking some calls in here?
Oh, sure,
during
sure.
The last two segments, we can start giving that number out,
sure.
and seeing. I'm sure there's so many people out there just dying to get their question in to you.
Sure.
But anyway, let me give that number out here in just a second. Anyway, doctor, how long have you been, you know, you said you've started retired from teaching. How long have you actually been, in-depth study of the subject, of this alternative knowledge or wisdom or however you want to call it?
Well, actually, it really goes way back to my youth.
It does.
I've been involved with it for most of my life.
Okay.
I just never had occasion where I thought it would be politically expedient.
Okay, that number.
Writing about it.
That number is 1-800-259-9231. Again, to our listening audience, 1-800-259-9231. There's a big. Are we seeing an awakening occur in the public at large in areas of spirituality and occultism and esotericism and so forth? What is happening out there?
Well, in my opinion, I think there certainly is an interest in it. I don't know if I would qualify it as an awakening, because I'm personally rather skeptical of the spiritual value of a lot of these esoteric traditions, principally because I'm coming increasingly to the conclusion that they really don't have much to do with spirituality at all. They have a lot to do with physics.
Yeah.
Right. So, are they used to control people, though, too, also? Just the
ideas?
Well,
they can be, certainly. You know, there's always that danger with this stuff. But I think that there's certainly an interest in it. I would ascribe what's going on more to the fact that I think we're looking at kind of a worldwide phenomenon of the collapse of all the orthodoxies across the board. In other words, in all the disciplines and in all the philosophies and religions and so on. I think more and more people are increasingly coming to question some of these things and to seek out their own answers. And I think part of that is due to the cynicism that is abroad in our political institutions some of the things, you know, our financial institutions and things like that.
Yes, I would like to ask a question pertaining to, you were talking about the Plato's Legend of Atlantis, would that
mm-hmm.
be right?
Mm-hmm.
The four levels,
mm-hmm.
could you briefly tell me about those?
Well, it has a lot to do with his myth or allegory of the cave. You know, he talks
sure.
about forms being displayed in shadows that are projected on a cave, and then people emerge gradually from the cave out into the full light. And he kind of ties that to this idea of levels. But one of the interesting things, if you look at this chart that I reproduce in Giza Vestar Deployed of the Jesuit Francis Coppleton, is that Plato describes the higher levels as being e mathematici, in other words, the mathematicals. Now, this is a rather stunning thing for someone writing way back then to actually say, because what he's really saying is that his forms have nothing whatsoever to do with what you learn that they mean in a standard academic philosophy class. In other words, you're taught in academics that, you know, you have several different individual chairs, for example. And in order to distinguish chairs from, say, desks or tables, we have an ideal form, chairness, so to speak, that all chairs partake of. Okay, that's the way you more or less kind of learn Plato academically if you go to a philosophy department. But what he's really saying is that these forms have specifically mathematical, and if he had known the word or known the discipline that we know today as topology, he probably would have used that. So he's talking in a very, very different way, ultimately, I think, than most people have been trained to see him. And this is where this whole physics idea comes in and how it ties into Atlantis. Because, of course, in his story, he says he's learning this from an uncle who was an Egyptian initiate.
Oh, my gosh, I tell you. We got to cut away here again, Doctor, and we're going to be right back. And we'll take some calls when we come back.
All right.
Thank you very much. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with
Charlotte Littlefield Brown.
Welcome back, Dr. Farrell. We've got a caller, Stuart, in Georgia. What's your question for Dr. Farrell, live on The Secret Truth? What's your question?
Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, Stuart, you're live on The Secret Truth.
Oh, okay. I was going to put forward a hypothetical question or a situation. Suppose that Atlantis is not interplanetary but interstellar, and knowing at sublight speeds and distance, they wanted to transmit a culture or implant a culture here, and knowing they would be cut off for millennia or generations anyway, they tried to pass on the technology in the form of religious symbolism. It's pretty far out, but...
Yeah, Dr. Farrell, what do you think about that? That's a good sort of a hypothesis there Stuart's putting forward.
Well, it's an interesting hypothesis. Actually, it's been advanced in various forms by people like Rupert Sheldrake, a famous biologist, and Dr. Michio Kaku, I think, has even spoken to the subject on a number of occasions. So it's not a new idea. It's certainly a possibility. It's certainly a possibility that would seem to be suggested by some of the ancient Sumerian texts, as a matter of fact. And if you read my book, The Cosmic War, I even present the views of a physicist by the name of Paul LaViolette, who presents a certain amount of evidence concerning pulsars that indicate that they may have been laid out in some sort of deliberate grid across the galaxy with the Earth as a specific frame of reference. So in other words, that these things might be some sort of some sort of interstellar galactic culture at work. So, you know, there's a certain amount of evidence to even corroborate your idea.
Wow.
What do you think about that, Stuart?
Well, yeah, that answers my question. I just thought it was an interesting idea to bring up.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much, Stuart, for your call. That's Stuart from Georgia. Thank you a lot. Okay, our next caller is Tom from Alaska. What's your question for Dr. Farrell? You're live on the Secret Trade.
I'm calling in reference to the esoterics. My research has led me to believe that Pythagorean actually was the first one to call himself a philosopher, and he was the one to explain that so above below, and mathematics explains everything. In your opinion, is this the start, and is this the mystery Babylonian, the Babylonian mystery religion that everybody talks about, in your opinion, is Pythagorean the beginning of this, and is this leading up to Nibiru, planet Nibiru, coming back? Thank
you. Okay. Two issues there. In answer to your question about Pythagoras, I present a certain amount of evidence in the pyramid books that would indicate that he's not the beginning of something, but he's simply handing something down, because there are very Sumerian type of numerological connections in his thinking. I think he's a part of this tradition. I certainly don't think he's the beginning of it. In answer to your question about Nibiru, that's really a speculation of Zechariah Sitchin and so on. And I just don't think, you know, I have a lot of difficulties with many portions of Mr. Sitchin's work. I just don't think the physics is there for this sort of celestial body to come careening into the solar system every few thousand years. And the reason I don't is I don't think the orbits of the planets that we see are eccentric enough in order for something like that to be true. So I'm not a subscriber to that idea.
Okay, Tom, does that answer your question?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. God rules.
Yeah, thank you for calling, and call us back again. Jeff from Idaho, what is your question for Dr. Farrell?
Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, Jeff, you're on the air, live with Secret Truth.
Hi, Dr. Farrell. I dug out the 1903 paper from Whitaker, and it said each consistent field is an undulatory character awaiting simple wave distribution propagation with uniform velocity.
Right.
You mentioned Gabriel Cron about his issues with his networking issues,
mm-hmm.
and then you mentioned the nuclear bombs yield issues.
Right.
Bendini in northern Idaho has worked out where scalar waves come out of his circuitry at 300 kilowatts peak power,
mm-hmm.
and that a soliton, when it propagates, generates
mm-hmm.
its own nonlinearity in front of itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you get a fuel air blast, it has almost the power of a nuclear explosion because it polarizes a lot of the particles.
Right.
Can all of these things, the way the sympathetic vibration that tickles the energy from the vacuum,
mm-hmm.
can it be kind of related to Walter Russell and his theories of expanding issues of light and gravity issues?
Well, I'm not familiar with Mr. Russell's work, so I really can't answer. I can speculate for you and say that I think probably they would.
It just has to do with the issues of the circulating patterns of current in a particle and what happens when it goes in a convergent or a divergent mode.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bendini issues look like they're convergent energy, as when we use normal electricity, it's divergent.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, and you know, this is the whole point of Lieutenant Colonel Bearden's last book, a massive book on a kind of a theoretical physics text on all of these issues, and that's one of the things that he brings out over and over again, really. And I think just to kind of tie it in with some of the other subject matter, I think that this may be more or less the thinking that it was at work inside of Nazi Germany when they rationalized the bell to have these two counter-rotating drums. I think that they were onto this principle in some form or another, so I think your insight is basically correct.
Yeah, when you get a big series resonant tank, the
mm-hmm.
current that circulates in that resonant tank,
mm-hmm.
you know, that just makes these currents circulate really, really super fast and
yes.
really high fields.
Yes.
So along that line?
Yes.
Okay, all right.
Thank you, Jeff, for your call, and call back again sometime. Thank you very much. Doctor, we have some pretty astute people out there, don't we?
I didn't follow that. Well, I think I've actually talked to this individual before on another show and exchanged.
Yeah, I think he's a pretty active caller, and he's a friend of ours too, friend of our program. Charlotte, what'd you think about some of that?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I'm still having semantic issues, when I hear nonlinear
mm-hmm.
In relation to the physics.
Okay.
I haven't gotten over that. There's just a few. I still have some hang-ups just because of definitions and what the word actually.
Let me kind of explain the two senses that nonlinear is often used by people in the literature, and it can be confusing because the two senses are somewhat divergent. In the first instance, nonlinear would mean that something exceeds by a great deal some sort of pre-experimental calculation of results. So, for example, in the Philadelphia experiment, they, I don't think, were looking for the optical invisibility of the ship, much less any of the other weird things that happened. They were looking for a much smaller degree of what they actually accomplished. But by dint of some parameters of the experiment, which we don't know because we don't have all the data about it, but by dint of some parameters when the experiment was performed in its full-scale version at sea, they crossed some threshold and these nonlinear, unanticipated effects began to occur. But the other sense that nonlinear is used in some of the literature is it's used to mean that energy or information does not travel from one point to another in normal space. It kind of pops down or pops up, if one prefers, into a kind of a subspace or a hyperspace and is transmitted at faster-than-light velocities. In other words, it's not traveling in the sense that we ordinarily think of, and that's kind of the other sense that it seems to have, so I hope that kind of clarifies it.
Is it quantum entanglement? Is that sort of the idea or not?
Yes, that's certainly an aspect of this. The Germans, we're back. We're back to Germany again.
Well, we can't get out of there, can we?
No, they
had some ingenious people there, didn't they?
They've always had some of the world's premier nonlinear physicists and mathematicians, as have the Russians. But the Germans recently, I think towards the turn of the millennium or shortly thereafter, performed an experiment where they actually communicated an entire movement of a Mozart symphony at faster than light velocities. So it's getting very sophisticated.
Boy, that's great. We got to cut away. We'll be right back for our final segment and ask you to give us some solutions. Thank you. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with
Charlotte Littlefield Brown. And before we move on to George and I, Dr. Farrell, we always like to end our last segment with a very positive note,
mm-hmm.
a way ahead,
mm-hmm.
On that type of solutions.
Yeah, okay. Okay, Charlotte, go ahead.
But I did have a question. As far as the nonlinear, would that mean also, since we're talking geometry and these things, would the spiral be the nonlinear?
Yes, it can mean that too. I mean, you have that idea at play as well. That would
so it's multiple.
Of, right.
There's
right.
multiple meanings, and then isn't nonlinear mathematics evolve into chaos theory?
It can, yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, George. Go ahead.
Okay, we got a caller I want to take real quick. Patricia from Illinois. Patricia from Illinois, welcome to The Secret Truth. You're live with Dr. Farrell. What is your question?
Thank you very much. Dr. Farrell, the thing that I'm most concerned about in this is the human heart.
Mm-hmm.
It bothers me that it's so much talked of as a weapon or a potential weapon, a formal weapon.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of good things can come out of this technology?
Well, obviously, if we have a technology that is able to tap into the energy of the fabric of space and time, then, or even a physics that would imply a technology like that, then we do have a potential solution not only to the economic mess that we're in, but also to the geopolitical mess that we're in, because we really don't need any more of these imperialistic wars and adventures and so on and so forth that have really plagued human history, you know, as far back as we go. So that's certainly one of the positive things that can come out of this. One reason I emphasize the weapon aspect of all of this science is because there is a certain trend in alternative research that views this physics as the literal godsend, you know, to a lot of these problems. And in a certain sense, it is. But I'm also trying to alert people that it has a very, very profound downside, and that we do have to be, as you point out, we do have to be spiritually able to handle this stuff, because this is potentially very, very dangerous stuff.
And I would see that we would have to develop a world community. It would have to, if it is deployed and fielded, it would have to be done rapidly and to everybody.
Okay, let me ask Dr. Farrell this. In your experience and the people that you know, do you think that it's fear or greed or selfishness? I mean, why have these people kept this to themselves and not shared it when it can have the potential to be so good?
Oh, that's an excellent question, Patricia. I think there's two answers to it, and one of them actually is a very altruistic one. This technology, if we go back and examine the alternative record very carefully to the details, it is something that is comparatively easy to engineer. In other words, you have the potential, as far as the weapons applications of this goes, you have the potential for a proliferation nightmare that makes our current dealings with Iraq and Iran and North Korea and some of these nations seem like child's play. So I think that one of their reasons is that they sense the extraordinary geopolitical implications of this stuff, and they're looking at this downside and saying that they've got to keep it in the bottle for as long as they possibly can. But I think your insight is correct on another point, and part of that is that it is not altruistic. I think that the global elite or the oligarchs or whatever you wish to call them are, to a certain extent, intending to monopolize these technologies for themselves and to keep it out of the hands of the rest of humanity. So there's certainly a greed and selfishness aspect to it as well.
Oh, that is so sad.
Yes, it is.
Is there?
We can all, those of us who believe in God, we can pray that somehow it'll be loosed from them and transferred to people who will do good with it.
Amen to that.
Are these men trying to play God with all these, the hiding and the, you know, the
hey
monopoly
guys,
of this
power? Hey, guys, this is the
power?
Solutions segment, and we are evolving. We're an evolving species, and most of these wars are over energy, power,
yes.
Money, and control.
Yes.
And there's 6 billion of us, and only a small fraction of us are being persecuted or living in a war environment. Most of the world is living in peace. Most of the world is living with the heart. And the systems, I believe it's the systems, the traditions that have been brought forward over these hundreds of years that need to be dismantled. And I think when they do, there's great hope.
Go ahead.
That goes to something I mentioned earlier. You know, I think that we are looking at some sort of paradigm shift in terms of popular awareness of some of these things. And I think part of it is due precisely, as you speak, to the cynicism that's abroad in most of our political and economic and cultural institutions. And I think that cynicism is only going to grow, but the problem here becomes, do we attempt, as I'm attempting to do, to raise public awareness of these things and get other people involved in researching and thinking about them independently and for themselves? So I think that's one aspect of the solution. I think it's just a matter of getting as much information out, and argue it carefully and well, and get it out and into as many people's hands as possible.
It seems like the public is ahead of the curve in this
Oh,
area.
Yes.
Yes, is that what you're saying there in another way?
Well, I think in a certain sense, at least, you know, you look at this election cycle in the United States and the cynicism toward both political parties and these puppet candidates that they've put forward is almost, to my memory, you know, I can remember President Eisenhower. I was a little boy, but I remember him. So, you know, I haven't seen a level of cynicism at any time in our nation's history like I've seen it now. And there's really no enthusiasm that is abroad for any of these candidates that really isn't a kind of a manufactured enthusiasm. So I think that there is some sort of sea change going on. I think it's going to be a major one. I think it's going to be with us for at least a generation.
It seems like the people are perceiving Ron Paul as a very sincere, you know, righteous stand-up person.
Yes, and
that's,
you know,
what I see. So the public is warming up to that versus, you know, these other candidates like maybe you described.
Well, the thing that to my mind really indicates that this may be a factor is that some of Ron Paul's views 30 years ago wouldn't have even been given the time of day, much less be some of the planks for a campaign of a major political party candidate. But now, you know, it's becoming more acceptable to question the constitutionality and, for that matter, even the practicality of institutions like the Federal Reserve and so on and so forth. You know, and again, in my memory, you really are looking at something of a sea change there with so many people supporting him and those types of ideas. And I don't think those ideas, you know, here's the bad news, elite, if you're listening, I don't think those ideas are going to go away. They are only going to increase, and the difference between the mainstream, so to speak, and the alternative community is only going to sharpen. So, you know, I think we're on the cusp of something major here in terms of a paradigm shift.
Yes, I agree with you.
Can you also call that like a quantum shift?
Well,
I think... Besides a paradigm shift, do you think there's actually something going on in the spiritual realm that is causing people to wake up?
There may be something spiritual going on. I don't discount that. But since the main emphasis of my more recent books has been on physics, I think that there may even be a physics explanation to some of this, because one of the things that you find in the ancient societies is the link that they deliberately made at almost every level between their understanding of science and their understanding of consciousness. You know, this is why astrology played such a large role in those societies. Well, again, I'm of the view that astrology is really a declined legacy of the very sophisticated science that that very high civilization had. And we may be looking at some manifestation of these things taking place right now.
So it's like an interchangeability?
I wouldn't say that. I think it's a bit more subtle than that. I don't think we're at the point yet where we have enough of this science nailed down to be able to say that.
But hopefully we're on our way.
I think we are.
Patricia, that's a song called Light a Little Candle that we
wonderful
end the show with.
So
maybe that's why we can go out here, light a little candle, right?
There's great hope, everybody. We're evolving.
For the
we
darkness is there. You know that it's there. Let God's light shine into the darkness there. That's the lyrics of that song. Thank you, Patricia, for your call.
Oh, you're very welcome. And God bless y'all.
Call back again. We certainly enjoyed your company.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Farrell, thank you very much. We certainly appreciate your time, and we really appreciate your insights that you've given tonight. And they're very valuable to us all. So
thank
you very much, and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night, sir. Thank you.
Well, Charlotte, good night, babe.
All right. Good night.
We're about out of here. Thank you for listening.